Welcome to Echolocation, the show that listens in on animal communication and features sound art and music inspired by the natural world. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and we're hearing the typical sounds of my neighborhood in Greene County, New York, during the short nights of early summer. It's a frenzy of frog love songs in the swamp across the road from my house. And this time of year, we're hearing tree frogs, green frogs, and bullfrogs in chorus. Regular listeners to this show will know that I always swoon over the vocalizations of frogs and toads. But each year, their breeding sounds seem to become even more precious because amphibians are particularly vulnerable to the effects of climate change. So we're devoting this broadcast to learning about an initiative that blends art, music, and science to raise awareness and inspire action on climate change. We'll start out with an interview with Stephen Crawford, who founded the Climate Music Project in 2014. And then we'll listen to excerpts from a brilliant composition entitled Climate by Eric Ian Walker, which was produced in partnership with the Climate Music Project. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of the project and what inspired it?
Well, the genesis was that I'm an artist here in San Francisco, and I had a number of years ago, back in 2008, I went back to school to get a second master's degree, and this time in environmental management, which is mostly environmental sciences based. I came out of that program with the real desire to somehow apply what I had learned to my art practice, and I was actually thinking of doing a kinetic sculpture that would somehow mimic the workings of the carbon cycle, and I had no idea how I was going to do that, and I was in my studio one night just sort of mulling it over and banging a metal rod against my workbench and sort of like tapping it, and that tapping suggested a rhythm, and then the rhythm suggested music, and that led to a whole different sort of channel of inquiry that I decided to try, and that led to a few garage band models, and then I showed it to a few friends, and that's how the project started. The inspiration really was just a deep-seated frustration. Again, I've as a grad student, for the first time around back in 1988, we did our first climate-related seminar back in 1988, and here we are in 2019, and the idea that this is an urgent issue still is not really out there broadly. I mean, even in the San Francisco Bay Area, which many people consider to be quite progressive on these issues, we find that while most people are aware of the issue, and certainly have heard of something called, whether you call it global warming, climate change, the climate crisis, certainly it's in the press now, but we still find that the urgency of the issue is still somewhat abstract, and that's what we're trying to communicate through this project.
I assume that when you started the project, it was just you, and it appears from your website that there are several people working on the project with you now. You have a scientific advisory committee, as well as musicians and other staff. Can you talk about the principal people involved with the project?
My colleagues insist that I call myself the founder, but I'm very cognizant of the fact that a project like this really does take a community. And although one person can have an idea, it really does take many people to execute it at a high level. And so over the years, now we've been in business since we became an organization in 2015. Right now we've got, depending how you count, how strictly you count, we've got between 25 and 30 people who are affiliated with the project across the sciences, arts, and technology, and then also public policy. We have a number of different sort of units. So we have a small executive team of three people. So it's myself, then Franz Schulberg, and Lori Goldman, both of whom are very experienced, both on running nonprofits, but also public policy and environmental policy. Then, as you mentioned, we've got a growing science team, which is the first scientist that we brought on was Dr. Andy Jones from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. The second person was Dr. Bill Collins, who is now our lead. We recently brought on two more scientists from UC Berkeley, David Ackerley and Wendy Silver. We have Allison Markline also from Berkeley, and we continue to expand the science team. They play a very important role in this project, which I can explain later on. Then we've got, of course, composers that we're expanding that as well. We've got a leadership council, which acts as our board. In effect, we are currently fiscally sponsored. So we're a nonprofit, but we're not a 501c3 yet. We're a project of a 501c3, so we don't have a strict board. We've got a leadership council. And then, equally importantly, we've got a whole corral of collaborators who are very important to the project, both for content development and then also just focusing on the action piece of it. So we work with a group called Kinetech Arts, which has been fantastic, helping us both explore how we can translate this into the language of dance, but also helping us with our advanced data animations. We work with the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and Torin Barrera is one of the professors there we work closely with. We're working with the British design firm Arup, that's been helping us with content for some of our performances. And then, as I mentioned, we've got a whole growing cadre of solutions partners, and those are very respected organizations that can help people to learn more about climate change, help them take action at home and society, and then also build community around engagement. So it's a growing community.
And how do you identify collaborators, particularly scientists and composers and musicians?
So, you know, the scientists, it's an organic process, because you know, what's been amazing about the project so far is just the deep commitment of the people who have been working on the project over now almost 4 years, really, since our first experimental concert. And so we really want to, as we expand the science team, we really want to find the scientists who, again, really buy into the idea here that we can sort of express insights about science through a musical language. Although we are, let me just stress, we're firmly footed in the world of art. We're not science, we're art, but we use science to help, or we use art rather to help communicate scientific concepts and insights. So with the scientists, we rely on our current scientists to suggest people who might be good to include as we expand outwards. The composers and musicians, composers is a group in the UK called the Creative Climate Coalition. It's run by a group called Julie's Bicycle out of London. And it's a list of artists who have committed to action on climate change. And so we're essentially going through that list. We're not quite ready to do that yet, but we're gonna be going through that list to identify artists who both are climate activists, but also who've had, for example, a record of collaboration with others. That's a really important factor. We're looking for diversity in the artists we work with, also different genres of music we want to reach out to and make sure that it's not just one type of music or sort of one. So the more diverse pool of our artists that we can work with, the better. And so we're starting out slowly, and I can explain a little later on how we've started so far and what we've already done in terms of who we worked with.
Your website is great, and I was really interested in several of the sections and some of the statements. So I'm just going to read a short statement from the website and then ask you to elaborate on it a little more. It says, "We created the Climate Music Project to harness this universal language to tell the urgent story of climate change to broad and diverse audiences in a way that resonates, educates, and motivates." So can you talk about how you feel music helps to do this and helps with the interpretation of climate science?
Sure. We like to say that it can help make climate science personal. That's to say that it can lend a visceral element to something that's otherwise abstract, that is the urgency of action on the climate crisis. So for example, let me just give you two examples. We often survey our, as often as possible, we survey our audience members after our performances to just get their feedback. And one woman actually gave us a quote that we like to repeat because it really does get to the heart of what we're trying to shoot for. After one of the performances, she said, "It's the most powerful visceral representation I have heard or seen, because through the rhythm, tempo, dynamics, pitch, we embody the music instead of just looking at and away from the data." So that idea of embodying sort of the data is really key to it. And again, let me give you one other story. One woman after one of our early performances back in 2015, we always have an audience engagement segment after our performances. So it's not just a concert and then people go home. We always have an introduction by one of our scientists, and then the performance, and then there's always an audience engagement segment where the audience has a chance to talk with the scientists, to talk with the composer, the artists, because that we find is something that there's a lot of energy in the room, and people really want to do that. They really want to connect with what they just experienced. And one woman actually, after one of our early performances, she stood up in front of the crowd, and she said, "You know, I was sitting here listening to the music and watching the years tick up on the animations." And she said, "You know, I was listening and I said to myself, that was how the music sounded when I was born." And then she said, "Well, this is how the music sounded when my daughter was born. And then later on, this is how the music might sound when my granddaughter might be born." And she said that for the first time, something that had been an abstract concept was firmly and squarely dropped into the arc of her family's own history. And she said that for her was a very powerful experience and really helped to see the issue in a different light. And that, again, those two examples, I think, are really what we're shooting for. Again, the last thing we want is people to go home and feel like they're alone. So we really think that community exercise afterwards is really important. Yeah, so and one other thing I should say, we like to think that we can use music as sort of a time machine, because in a half an hour, we can take people into the past, musically, bring them to the present, take them into the future, explore different possible futures, and then bring them back to the present, all in about half an hour. So in that regard, music is also a little bit like a time machine.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. And are the pieces in general around 30 minutes? I know the ones that I've listened to on the website are excerpted, but it looked like they're around that length.
Well, currently we're performing two pieces, and I can talk about those a little later. But yeah, the two pieces we're currently performing are both just about 30 minutes, although that won't necessarily be the case in the future. In fact, we're working on one right now that is only going to be 10 minutes. So we're looking for a wide variety of compositions that could fit into many different situations or contexts.
So I'm going to give you another quote from the text on the website. "We enable the creation and staging of science-guided music and visual experiences to inspire people to engage actively on the issue of climate change." So we've just been speaking a little about the science-guided music and visual experience collectively for folks who attend performances. But can you give some examples of how this experience can inspire action and what actions you're encouraging people to take?
Yeah, sure. So it inspires action by, specifically, it's communicating the urgency of the issue in a fresh, accessible, and engaging way. So really, we're focusing on not climate science 101. We're really trying to get across very specifically, hey, this is a really urgent issue, and we're all making it, we all have a choice to make here. And so that's really the message in all of our music. We then facilitate, it's the facilitation of action via a growing network of solutions partners. So sort of the music acts as a vehicle to sort of, it's a hearts and minds approach to activate the mind through the heart. And then we take that energy and channel it to organizations that can actually help people understand what they can do. And I have to say that we see climate change as a symptom of the unsustainable ways that we've organized our economy and society over the years. So that there are a lot of ways that people can actually take action. Generally speaking, our advice is that if you don't know very much about the issue, learn more and take the first steps. If you're already taking action, explore what more you can do. And if you're already doing everything you can do, then motivate your friends and colleagues. So I mentioned these solutions partners. We're working with sort of respected, very respected nonprofit organizations that can help people to, you know, learn more about the issue, take action at home, and then build community moving forward. Right now, there are five of them. And we're actively expanding that network. Let me just tell you who they are. They're the San Francisco Department of the Environment for the local audiences here. Then there's an organization called Global Footprint Network that can help people to learn more about their both individual and collective footprint on this planet, and how sort of really how to analyze that, which is a very insightful exercise. They're a great organization. We work then with a group called Cool Effect, which has a number of projects, many projects around the world that are looking at carbon sequestration that people can participate in. Then we have a group called Revolve, which is community-based solar. And then we've got a group called Interfaith Power and Light, which is a network of about, I think, over 10,000 interfaith congregations around the country that are committing to action on climate change, and also to teach people about climate change, and then also to apply it via solar solutions on the rooftops of churches, things like that. Yeah, and again, we're looking to expand that as well. This is not a static sort of group of partners. So we're looking for organizations that whose missions can complement what we're doing, and that's the key, because we're not in a position to actually help people act. We're in a position to sort of spark that and motivate that action, and then we, again, as I mentioned, we look to channel that action or that energy into organizations that can absorb it.
That's great. So while we're talking about partnerships, I'm just going to skip down to another question, more specifically about, rather than action partnerships, musical partnerships. And I read that in May, there was a collaborative concert of student works at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Can you talk a little about that partnership and that project?
Yeah, that's been great. So the San Francisco Conservatory of Music has a department called Technology and Applied Composition. And this is a department that helps, that basically educates students on use of new technology, music technology for composition. And so we've been working with them over 2 years now. This is the second year. And each year has culminated in a performance of student work. So we actually start the semester by having one of our scientists give a briefing to the students on the basics. So this is Climate Science 101 then, just so to bring them up to speed on the issue. And then we actually provide them with scenarios and data sets to work with, and then work with them during the course of the semester. And then that culminates in a concert of student works. We're also doing this, though, our purpose also is to just see what creative minds can do, how far creative minds can take this idea of bringing music together with science, and what new ideas might still there need to be discovered, because it is a field that I think we're really only scratching the surface in terms of what's possible. And we're really wanting to up the ante a little bit in the next year to come up with new techniques, new ways of making this work.
I'm interested in the way that works are inspired and created based on data, but not using data sonification or a direct use of the data. And in general, from what I could glean, it looks like that is the approach of the composers that are featured on your site. But is that also the approach with the student works?
There are a number of different techniques we can use. We like to say we help to create science-guided music, and the key here really is that it is music. Again, if we were just to do data sonification, and although some of our pieces may make use of direct data sonification, if we were only to do that, it would not be very musical, and most people probably would not want to sit down and listen to it. So we're really looking to create music that is engaging and yet directly references the science in some way that we can define. And so there are a number of techniques that we can use. We have been using a form of a technique called parameter mapping. And that's basically where variables in the system that we want to model, so in this case, the climate system, are assigned analogs in the musical score. And then these analogs then track changes in the climate variables as measured against a reference value over time. So for example, you could imagine a piece where, temperature, near Earth temperature is mapped to tempo in the piece, for example, and then the tempo would in the piece would follow basically the how the changes in or the variations in temperature through that data set. Now that's not a technique that we would just use by itself, because what I mentioned earlier that the scientists are very important in this process, and they are, because they really what it comes down to is an intensive interaction between the scientists and the composers to really help the composer understand what the science is telling us. It's not just data driven in that regard, because you know music is not the climate. And so it's not a perfect analogy. And so we need the scientists to help the composer understand, for example, how much different would a 2-degree warmer world be than the world that we currently have? And to the average person on the street who doesn't have the advantage of understanding the science, 2 degrees difference may not sound like very much. And so, you know, we wouldn't want that reflected in a musical score as just being a little bit of a change. We want it to be what it would be, which is a very significant change. And so it's not, although we use techniques like parameter mapping, we do use some direct data sonification, it's that interaction between the scientists and the composers that really makes this music work as music. It's that conversation, so that's really important.
Yeah, and what I've listened to, it really does work as music. And like, for example, the piece Climate, the emotive quality of that piece is very powerful.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I mean, you know, and here's the other thing I should mention is that, again, you know, we would never say that the music we make is what the climate sounds like. That's not what we're saying. What we want to do is we want to have a piece that, again, reflects concepts from the science and insights from the science in a musical way. But at the same time, what we do in all of our performances is that we bookend our performances with real scientific context. So for example, when we start a performance, we have a scientist give an introduction first, explaining exactly why we're doing this and how the music relates to the science. And then after the performance, we have the scientist up there again, taking questions about the science. What is near Earth? What is Earth energy balance? That's one of our pieces, for example, we model Earth energy balance. And a lot of times people don't know what that is. And so it's an opportunity to also educate our audiences about basic issues in climate science that may not be very clear.
And can you elaborate on that a little bit and talk about, I think currently you have two pieces featured on your website, and talk about both of those?
Yeah, so the first piece is called, and this is our first piece that we premiered in 2015. It's called Climate by composer Eric Ian Walker in collaboration with the Climate Music Project. It looks essentially at the physical science of climate change as it is manifest in the climate system. His piece runs over 450 years from the year 1800 to the year up to the present, and then into the future to the year 2250 AD. In this piece, 25 years equals one minute in the score for 29 minute total runtime. The mappings in this piece are pretty straightforward. So carbon dioxide is mapped to tempo in this piece. Near Earth atmospheric temperature is mapped to pitch. In this case, it's pitch in one direction. So as the temperature goes up, the pitch goes up. That's pretty straightforward. And then the Earth energy balance, or the balance between the incoming solar radiation from the sun and outgoing infrared radiation from the Earth, is mapped to distortion. So the more out of balance that is, the more distorted the piece sounds. And so those are the mappings we use for that piece. In terms of style, it's performed by a 5-piece band. So there is a violinist, there are 2 keyboardists, there's a synthesizer, and then there's also someone doing live mixing on stage and also live sampling on stage. So it's a mixture of electronic and acoustic instruments. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece is called Icarus in Flight, and it's completely different. This piece is by composer Richard Festinger, and it is looking at and explores human drivers, 3 human drivers of climate change over 200 years from 1880 to 2080 AD. In this piece, 1 year equals 8 seconds for a 27-minute total runtime. So in this piece, he has 3 variables that we're mapping. And the mappings in this case are very different. Let me also say this piece is for chamber music. It's classical music. So very different from the first piece. And it does, again, just show how many options we have in terms of how to express these ideas musically. So this is in a chamber genre here. And so population growth, the composer maps to the density of musical events over time. So the higher the population, the more crowded the music sounds per unit time. Carbon emissions are mapped to pitch, but this time in two directions. So think of the piece starting in the middle of the register, and then as the carbon emissions rise, the pitch goes both up and down, so that by the end of the piece, under the business as usual scenario, the pitch is both very, very high and very low, and it's very easy to pick out. And then land use change, or rather how humans are transforming the natural landscape, are mapped to specialized playing techniques. So the composer basically picked out a number of techniques that are very easy to hear because they sound odd when the musicians play them on their instruments. So you can pick them out very easily, and the more of those that there are, that reflects the more we're changing the natural landscape over time. And again, like climate, this piece also is synced to data animation. It's a multi-sensory experience, but this time it's just like text, but also a very powerful piece, and also extremely musical. So one thing I should say is that both of these pieces, I think if you listen to them, you'll find that they can be experienced on two levels. One level is just an emotional level, intuitive level, as music. And we actually even advise our audiences just to almost not to ignore, but just to enjoy the experience of the performance as music and not try to analyze too much. Because just as music, they convey something in the tension and the toggling back and forth between the different scenarios that creates a tension, it creates crescendos. There's a musicality there that says something about what's happening in the data. And so we really advise our audiences just to enjoy the performance and the experience as music. And then, of course, there's that second level, the analytical level, that, yes, you could stop the music at any time, and then we could talk about why it's actually doing what it's doing specifically at that point. And we think that most people probably experience the performances on that first level, on the intuitive, emotional level. Some people might also experience it on an analytical level, but let me just say that you could experience it on either level, and it would still be impactful.
And in terms of experiencing it on the analytical level, can you explain a little bit more about the use of video and visual images to interpret the data conveyed in the music?
Well, they're just, for example, the data animations, they're just animations of the data sets. So you could see, for example, on climate, if you look at the beginning, for example, there's a point where in 1883 where Krakatoa erupts. And that spews out a bunch of particulate matter into the atmosphere, which results in basically you'll see the Earth energy balance dip right then in 1883, 1884. And then you also see the temperature slowly go down a little bit, just dip a little bit. And so that's an example of a natural variation in the climate system. So you can watch these data animations, and it'll be what's happening to the data animations is reflected in the music. So,
and then I was curious about upcoming works and where the climate music project is presently and going in the future.
Well, so we're currently working with, we have two upcoming works that are, one is about midstream. It's with a group called COPUS here in San Francisco, that's COPUS. They're actually award-winning ensemble. They're the winner of the 2019 Closing International Music Awards for Best Spoken Word. And they're doing a piece with us on sea level rise. This is the 10-minute piece that I mentioned a little earlier today. And we're about midstream on that one. We hope to premiere it in the fall, probably September, October timeframe. And then we are also about to start, in a few weeks, we'll be starting a new collaboration with an LA-based Grammy winner. That's really exciting for us. And this will be something completely different. This will be actually a music video for kids focusing on the impact of climate change on biodiversity. And it's going to be potentially it may be a hip hop conversation between two characters. We don't know yet, but the artist we'll be working with is incredibly creative, and so we're really looking forward to seeing what comes out of that. And that will start in about a week and probably take us maybe certainly months into towards the end of the year probably. And then in terms of what's next for the Plant Music Project, you know, we are sort of pivoting away from early, you know, when we started in 2015, 2016, really what we were curious to know was whether this could work. And so the first couple of years of performances were just sort of trying to get a sense for how does this impact audiences? Is it something that we really can build on? And I think the experience of the first couple of years and the audience feedback we've received suggests that, yes, it is absolutely something we can build on, especially, though, if we can expand the content. Because music is a universal language, but it has many idioms. It has many dialects, rather. And so, you know, rather than just have us create music here in San Francisco and then try to take it on the road around the country or other places, even the world. In fact, we just did our first international performance last year in Mexico City. Our model moving forward will be to enable very brilliant artists, wherever they are, to work with us to create their own versions of climate music for their own communities, their own fan bases, their own concerts. And so that's really what we're working on now. We're working on a methodology that will allow us to compress the time frame it takes to create one of these pieces, because it is, you can imagine, a very time-intensive process by the time you work through what the science will be, how to convey that into music, how the, you know, the scientists sit down with the composers over months and work things out, and then create the visuals as well. That's a long process. Both of our first two pieces took about a year each to create. And so looking ahead, we think the way we're going to really increase our impact will be to increase our ability to enable others to create this content. And again, this will be through a curated fashion, looking at artists who have the potential to have a big impact and who also understand the urgency of the issue and want to utilize or leverage a very fresh way to use music to do this. And so that's where we're headed right now. We're well down the road on that front. And we're all very optimistic and excited to see this through. You know, music speaks to people in so many different ways. And you know, we don't want to assume that one piece that we create here is going to do that for everybody. And so we really do think that the way we're going to do that is just by, there's so many creative minds out there that want to actually engage on this issue and want to be part of the solution, and we're looking for those. You know, we really want to work with those people and find ways to accelerate the process.
Well, that's really fantastic. But your work is very exciting. Is there anything that you'd like to add that I haven't covered? Any statements that you'd like to make before we close the interview?
We'll have all of our upcoming events on our website. The website is climatemusic.org. You can find everything about us there. We're also now, maybe I should also mention, we're also not only going to be doing live performances, but we'll be doing, we're looking to expand our digital content so that we'll have the ability to, for example, screen videos in different locations. As I mentioned, this new piece that we're working with the LA-based artist will be a music video. So it's, you know, live performances are great, and that's what we're really going to continue to focus on, but we're also understand that we live in a digital age and that we're really going to be working to get out digital content as well.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM in New York's Greene and Columbia counties and worldwide at wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lou Judas, and we've just listened to an interview with San Francisco-based artist Stephen Crawford, who is the founder of the Climate Music Project. Now we're going to tune into a composition entitled Climate by Eric Ian Walker. And as Stephen just described, this composition is performed live, accompanied by a video that provides graphic depictions of the climate data that inspired it. And you can go to the Climate Music Project website, climatemusic.org, to watch excerpts of the video as you listen to this beautiful composition, which tracks changes in global conditions from the 19th century through the present, and then projects possible scenarios all the way out to the 24th century. The video starts with a brief introduction, so we'll listen in on some of that now.
One of the first steps in creating this score was determining what the most extreme degree of musical dysfunction would sound like at the end of the piece in the year 2300. We then worked backwards from there as a control point to plot the degree and type of change to the music according to the corresponding climate data. According to the scientific model, we used climate data beginning from the year 1800 up to the current date and projected ahead to the year 2300, with every 25 years equaling 1 minute. We could then set the climate data to tempo, pitch, rhythm, distortion and modulation, level of chaos, and the position of a knob on any music device. The four climate variables used in this piece, and their music corollary, are atmospheric CO2, which is tempo, near-surface air temperature, pitch and harmony, incoming and outgoing long-wave radiation, also known as Earth's energy balance, distortion, modulation, level of chaos, and ocean pH, which is affected by the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. This controls form in the music. If all of the variables are relatively normal, the music will sound relatively normal. But as the variables change, it may sound like the musicians are playing out of key, playing different pieces, speeding up, or sounding like it is going through an audio meat grinder. Also, this is a live performance by musicians who, with each performance, make different decisions about how to play their parts. This is analogous to the randomness that naturally occurs in our climate system and was built in to the execution of the piece. So this music is a sonic translation of our climate system, where it was in the past, what is happening to it now, and what the future will bring.
So let's listen to some excerpts from the piece, and Stephen Crawford will provide a little interpretation of the composition as it progresses through time.
It starts in the year 1800. It starts with a very sort of pastoral melody, very quiet, very peaceful. Thank you. And then as the 20th century gets well underway, it kind of metamorphosizes into this. People have described it as almost like a Pink Floydish kind of theme that then moves into the end of the 20th century, into our time, and then into the future. It runs across mostly one scenario for the future that you could dub business as usual. But at one point, it drops down to briefly explore what another scenario might be, which is essentially the scenario or the curve we could achieve if we were to, for example, fully implement the Paris Accord. And so there's a contrast in the piece that is very, very, very noticeable.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties and worldwide at wavefarm.org. We've been listening to a piece entitled Climate by Eric Ian Walker in partnership with the Climate Music Project, performed by Mikhail Walther, Thomas DiMuzio, Scott Brazial, and Bill Nordiker. The composer worked with scientists to use climate data to inform components of the musical score to illustrate change over time. The song started in the 19th century, moved through the 20th and into the 21st century, sonically depicting the disruption to the Earth's systems caused by warming above 1.5 degrees Celsius. And as the piece moves into the 22nd century, it changes drastically and very suddenly from a chaotic cacophony to a calmer melody, which demonstrates the difference between 6 degrees of warming and the 1.5 degrees agreed upon by the Paris Accord. And the piece then slowly returns to a scenario of runaway warming up to 9 degrees as it moves into the 23rd and through the 24th centuries. And I highly recommend that you watch the video excerpts of this piece at the Climate Music Project website, which is climatemusic.org. The video features visual and graphic depictions that help to orient the listener more fully to the composition's journey through time and into possible futures. And the end of the piece returns to the music of the 19th century. And as that happens, the video zooms out to space and looks down upon the Earth, reminding us that this blue planet is our one and only home. Thanks so much to Stefan Crawford and to all of the folks at Climate Music Project for sharing their work with us this evening. And thanks to all of you for listening to WGXC. You can find out more about Climate Music Project and check out steps that you can take to help avert the climate crisis by visiting climatemusic.org. And please don't forget that WGXC is a community radio station that survives on the donations of listeners. And we're especially trying to recruit sustaining monthly members to help the station continue to operate smoothly. So please visit wavefarm.org and check out the WGXC page to learn how you can contribute to the station. This is Elizabeth Lo Judas and A Swamp Full of Amorous Amphibians signing out.